The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone!
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Crew.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
So this is the podcast episode that didn't want to ever exist.
Hey, seriously.
We've literally tried three different programs today to get this to work. And then we had at least twice we tried to meet before to record this. First, notes randomly disappeared, and then the program we used to record skipped half of it, and then it did it again after we recorded half the episode. So we're gonna give this another go and see what happens.
Yep.
So if we sound like we've said this before, it's because we have. So this episode we also meant to record originally before Christmas because we wanted to have an episode on alcoholism because it's pretty prevalent in the US and around the world, and it's very heavily tied to what we do. And we thought that doing it around the holidays was pretty relevant since a lot of people need a few drinks in them to deal with family. But then I couldn't drink when we had to record it before the holidays. So we decided to push it back so you can recover from your holidays and deal with your New Year's resolutions listening to an episode about alcoholism.
Which may involve doing a dry January. I've heard that's like a thing people do.
That is a thing people do. I cannot imagine doing it, but I am glad people have self-control.
But we delayed it so much that I have lost my voice. So I apologize for sounding like somebody who has smoked 5 packs of cigarettes a day for my entire life. I have not.
Smoking is bad for you.
Don't do it.
Nicole lost her voice because she was screaming in this special effects thing that they have at Universal this past weekend. She has an impressive scream, which led to them wanting her for the sound effects.
And it was quite fun.
Yes.
Although I was extremely nervous when I first went up.
She was so good. It was so good. Oh my God. It was so funny.
But the price I pay is my voice.
So you're welcome. So alcoholism. It's also known as alcohol use disorder, and it's defined as the drinking of alcohol that results in mental or physical health problems. It's defined a handful of ways. The more common way that people know of is defined by the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And they define binge drinking as the amount of alcohol that leads to a blood alcohol content of 0.08, which is the legal limit. So in a 2-hour period, that's 5 drinks for men and 4 drinks for women. They also say that you're at risk for alcohol-related problems if you're a man and you drink more than 4 drinks a day, or more than 14 drinks per week, or for women, you have more than 3 drinks in a day, or more than 7 drinks in a week.
The double X chromosome ruins the party again.
Not enough body mass and not enough enzyme to break down the alcohol. And importantly, one drink is defined as either a 12-ounce beer, 5-ounce glass of wine, or a 1.5 ounce of distilled spirit.
Or 8 ounces of malt liquor.
Right. I always forget about malt liquor.
And importantly, the 12 ounces of beer is specifically referring to 5% alcohol content, with which very few beers in the United States, I feel like, are.
Yes. My favorite beer is from Vermont, and it only comes in a 16-ounce can, and it's 8% alcohol. So that would be like at least 2, if not 3 drinks based on what is technically counts as a drink. So if I had one of those, it would almost put me over the edge of counting as at risk for alcohol problems.
Oh, yeah. And my favorites are all Belgian beers, which are also very high percentages, although they tend to serve them to you in the smaller pours.
That's true. So doctors have a lot of ways to suss out these problems. One of them, there's a lot of them, so I'm only going to mention one, is called the CAGE questionnaire. It's a series of questions that if you answer positives to 2 of them, you kind of ask more questions. So CAGE is an acronym. C is for, have you ever felt the need to cut down on your drinking? A is, have people annoyed you by criticizing your drinking? G is, have you ever felt guilty about drinking? And E is, have you ever needed an eye opener or a drink in the morning to get you over the hangover, to get you going? So, like I said, 2 out of 4 is enough to put you towards further questions. And this is good for the general population, but isn't good for people with less severe problems. White women are college students.
College students.
College students. So that's like, you're surrounded by people that drink. So have you ever felt the need to cut back? No, everybody does it. Mm. Nobody's annoyed by your drinking because everybody's drinking. So there are situations where it's not the best, but in the general population is better.
And then in terms of prevalence, about 25% of adults aged 18 and over have had at least one heavy drinking day. So that's a binge drinking day in the past year. So 1 out of 4 adults. And then approximately 6.2% or 15 million adults in the United States meet the criteria for alcohol use disorder.
That's a lot of people.
Yes. So roughly 20%, so 1 in 5 of college students meet the criteria for That's alcohol crazy. Use disorder. And 1 in 4 college students report academic consequences from drinking, such as missing class, falling behind, doing poorly on exams or papers, and receiving lower grades overall.
I saw in one place that 1,825 college students between 18 and 24 die from alcohol-related injuries every year, including MVA.
What?
Almost 2,000. Almost 700,000 students between 18 and 24 are assaulted by another student who's drinking. 700,000.
Wow.
And almost 100,000 students, again, between 18 and 24, experience alcohol-related sexual assault or date rape.
Wow.
Too many. So college is an environment when alcohol becomes prevalent and normal. It's very normalized, but it then leads to a lot of issues.
Yeah.
Other things that I saw that were interesting were more than 10% of U.S. children live with a parent with alcohol problems. So more than 1 in 10. And then for someone that is exposed to a parent or a sibling with an alcohol use disorder, they're 3 to 4 times more likely to develop it themselves.
Oof.
So 10% of children are exposed to it, and they then become 3 to 4 times more likely to develop alcohol use disorder.
Cycle.
It's a bad cycle.
And then in terms of mortality, which is the reason why you're all here, the number of alcohol-induced deaths, excluding accidents, homicides, and newborn deaths associated with maternal alcohol use, there are about 35,000 per year.
And then if you lump all those back in, excessive alcohol use is responsible for 88,000 deaths per year in the U.S., including 1 in 10 total deaths among working age adults.
1 in 10.
1 in 10. It's the third leading preventable cause of death after, as Nicole alluded to earlier with her smoking problem, not a smoking problem, screaming too much, tobacco is the leading preventable cause of death, and poor diet and exercise is the second.
Wow. So in terms of the health consequences of drinking alcohol, there are short-term consequences and long-term consequences. The short-term consequences include things like injuries, which we have mentioned already. So motor vehicle crashes, falls, drownings, burns, you're all more likely to get those if you are drinking alcohol in the short term. And then violence in the short term is a risk of alcohol use. So homicide, suicide, sexual assault, and intimate partner violence, you're at increased risk of. And there are several studies that found significant increases in suicide, gun violence, and also homicide. So of all of the violence statistics, the one I found the most interesting was that a meta-analysis published in 2011 found that 48% of homicide victims tested positive for alcohol.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah. Just under half.
And it's victims, not assailants.
Yes. And then also in the short term, you're at increased risk of risky sexual behaviors. Mm-hmm. So unprotected sex or sex with multiple partners, which can lead to unintended pregnancy or sexually transmitted diseases. If you are a pregnant woman and you drink, you're at increased risk of miscarriage and stillbirth, as well as fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And then one of the most important for forensic pathologists, short-term consequences of alcohol is alcohol poisoning.
Yeah. So I'm going to briefly walk through the different blood alcohol levels and the associated side effects, for lack of a better way. So at the very low end, So again, the legal limit is 0.08 for driving. From 0.03 to 0.12. And again, there's going to be a range in all of these because different people have different effects at different levels after they've built tolerance. So 0.03 to 0.12, improvement in mood or euphoria, increased self-confidence, sociability, and decreased anxiety.
I see no downsides to this level.
Which isn't that bad. And that's why people drink. They drink to get to this point. But as we said, this is a good range. So you can bump over that from 0.09 to 0.25, which overlaps with the prior range. And you can start to be lethargic, sedated, have balance problems and blurred vision. So it's a very fine line to get over into some of these less desired effects. And then a little more from 0.18 to 0.3, you can get profound confusion, impaired speech, staggering, dizziness, and vomiting. Again, a little more, 0.25 to 0.4. So we're significantly above the legal limit at this point. Stupor, unconsciousness, and terror-grade amnesia. So forgetting what happened the night before, blackouts or brownouts. Vomiting, which can lead to inhalation and death, and then respiratory depression. So your body isn't remembering to breathe correctly. And then the final cutoffs, which again have a very wide range from 0.35 to 0.8, you can get coma, life-threatening respiratory depression, and alcohol poisoning. So what is alcohol poisoning exactly? So this is usually from binge drinking. So, you know, vast quantities of alcohol in a short period of time. And the amount that you need to get there varies by person. Some of the signs and symptoms we talked about, confusion, vomiting, seizures, slow breathing. And that means like less than a breath a minute or more than 10 seconds between breaths. And then that low oxygen in leads to blue tinged or pale skin. You can get hypothermia, which is where all the vessels towards your skin start to dilate and you just give off heat. And then you can pass out. Usually this is, of course, from ethanol, but you can get it from the other alcohols too. And then kind of the final complications leading to death from this that we see on autopsy are choking, just stopping breathing, severe dehydration, seizures, hypothermia, an irregular heartbeat, so your heart can't effectively get the blood around your body, brain damage, and of course, leading to death. So those are all the short-term things. So you can go anywhere from like being slightly euphoric to ending up dead from alcohol poisoning in the short term.
And then in the long term, so chronic use of alcohol, the main thing that you can get are tons of different chronic diseases. The one that people most commonly associate long-term alcohol use with is liver disease. So unlike if your brain or your heart fails, when your liver fails, you do not die a sudden death. You die a slow, multi-organ shutdown death.
Painful death. Yes. Very painful.
So in the initial stages of chronic alcohol use, you can get fat deposition in your liver. So it's something called steatosis. And this is reversible. So if you stop drinking, it can go away. And steatosis is seen in up to 90% of patients who present for treatment of chronic alcoholism. If you don't stop your drinking, then on top of the fat depositing in your liver, you also get a bunch of inflammation. And this is steatohepatitis. And then...
not reversible.
Not reversible. And then if you continue to drink, damage your liver, you eventually get to end-stage liver disease, and this is cirrhosis. And this is essentially replacement of your normal liver tissue with scar tissue or fibrosis. And at that point, your liver becomes very firm and nodular, and it's
a very distinct feel. Like once you felt it once or twice, it's like, that's cirrhosis, and a very distinct look.
Yeah. And once that happens, all of the things that your liver is supposed to do, it stops doing. So one of the main things that your liver does is it helps to clear toxins from your body. When it's not doing that, you can get neurological disturbances. So a buildup of ammonia can make you become confused, cause tremors. Your liver also is in charge of producing a lot of the things in your blood that help you to stop bleeding or not clot too much. So when your liver stops working, you can get either problems with bleeding or too much clotting. Your blood also goes back through your liver. It's part of how it helps to detoxify you. And if it gets all fibrosed, then your blood can start to back up in your body. Mm-hmm. So it can cause increased pressure in various other organs, the main being your gastrointestinal system. So it can cause your vessels in your esophagus, for example, to become very big and put you at risk of bleeding.
And so, like, if you throw up because you've drank too much and you have these big vessels, they can burst and then you just start throwing up blood.
And that can kill you.
Bad things.
Yes. When your liver starts to shut down, it can also affect your kidneys and your lungs. So it can cause those two different organ systems to work inappropriately. And then cirrhosis also puts you at increased risk for a specific type of cancer called hepatocellular carcinoma.
Mm-hmm.
So besides liver disease, alcohol also causes heart disease. So in particular, you can get something called dilated cardiomyopathy.
One of the forensic pathology textbooks, I think, described this really well. So dilated cardiomyopathy is kind of what it sounds like. Your heart gets dilated, so it's kind of this big, saggy heart, and you can no longer effectively pump blood. And this book talks about how the myocardial damage in this case can be due to the direct toxic effect of the alcohol, the nutritional effects of chronic alcoholism that we'll get into in a little bit, as well as toxic effects of an additive to the alcohol, for example, cobalt. So not only does this damage come from the alcohol itself, but from some of the chronic effects of other things, as well as some of the additives. It's not just the alcohol that gets you.
And then chronic alcohol use also puts you at risk for a bunch of different neurological disorders. You can be at increased risk of cerebrovascular disease, so mm-hmm. increased risk of stroke. I mentioned before that if your liver can't clear the toxins, it can put you at risk for this thing called encephalopathy, which causes confusion and tremors.
Yep.
I mentioned earlier also that you're at increased risk of injury. So head trauma is a big problem with people who use alcohol chronically.
And then, of course, since you're at increased risk of bleeding, if then you get head trauma, then you get a head bleed and it just kind of builds on itself.
Yep. And then Jordan mentioned nutritional deficiencies. So one of the things, if you're, you know, drinking a lot of alcohol, then you're kind of neglecting your diet maybe. So one of the things that you could be deficient in is something called thiamine. And this can cause a particular syndrome that we can see on autopsy based on its different effects in the brain. So there's this one region in particular, your mammillary bodies, that can start to look a distinctive way if you are a chronic alcohol user.
And I love the name of this syndrome. It's called the Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome.
Which is much better than I would pronounce it.
So it's, I don't know, it's something that was really heavily talked about in med school.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few things that we can actually see, which is cool.
Yeah. So alcohol use attacks your liver, heart, your brain, and it also attacks your GI system. So I mentioned before, increased risk of bleeds, but also you're at increased risk of getting inflammation in your pancreas, and that can either be acute or chronic. And you are also at increased risk of different types of cancer.
And that's everything from the mouth, throat, larynx, esophagus, through your colon, as well as your liver, as Nicole mentioned earlier, and actually breast cancer too. Which the other ones kind of make sense because it kind of touches all the way down, but it does increase your risk for breast cancer.
Yeah.
And then overall, heavy drinking reduces your life expectancy by about 10 years. So it's a solid decade hacked off your life.
Yeah. So think of all those Instagram posts you made about the decade for 2020. Just take that away.
Yep. One whole chunk gone.
Yes.
Of course, there's a lot of bad things that come from chronic heavy alcohol use. But drinking in moderation isn't necessarily bad. So if you drink a small amount of alcohol over time, it actually increases your insulin level and can lower your risk of diabetes. It can reduce the number of small strokes called TIAs that you can get. It also can increase your good cholesterol, which is also known as HDL, and it can improve blood flow and decrease the plaques that you get. So when you look at the heart of a chronic alcoholic, you see kind of a bigger, floppier heart. But the vessels are super clean. It's kind of creepy. Like, they're kind of perfectly clean.
And this is not to say that if you don't drink, you should start drinking.
Yes, because you'll still get the big floppy heart and the liver disease and all the other bad things. In moderation, it has been proved to do a few good things.
So everything in moderation.
And then finally, with side effects and medical side effects, people that drink chronically over time can experience something called alcohol withdrawal. So if you're drinking many drinks a day and then you stop suddenly, this can also kill you. And there's some really good protocols out there that help you slowly get off of alcohol. And so it's something that all medical providers will know as CWA, which is the Clinical Institute Withdrawal Assessment. So it takes all of your signs and symptoms of withdrawal. So that includes things like tactile, so feeling, auditory, and visual hallucinations and disturbances, and quantifies them. It looks at how nauseous you are or how much you've been vomiting, if you have a tremor, if you're sweating, and it quantifies all of that. And then you take that number. So let's say your CWA score is 12. You look in the 11 to 14 range, and it's associated with taking this much of this benzodiazepine, which is a way to, you know, stop all those side effects and help you slowly get the alcohol out of your system in a safe way. So binge drinking can be very bad. Also, stop drinking suddenly can also be bad. So if you know somebody or see somebody that's doing this, get them to the hospital, because we have some great ways to get them safely off of alcohol. And then finally, there are a lot of other medications out there that can help treat or stop you from drinking. The only one that I want to mention is called disulfiram. And this is a medication that you take every day. And then if you have a drink, you just feel horrible. So it's a deterrent. So it's like you now associate drinking with feeling horrible. Kind of like a hangover immediately.
Ew.
So exactly. So there's a lot of good ways that we know to treat it. And if you catch it early enough, as Nicole said, some of these reversible things can completely go away. And yep, you can work on it. So drink in moderation.
If you drink at all.
If you drink at all. And do it safely. So as always, we're going to end this with some stories on alcohol or alcohol related things.
Yes. We don't always end with alcohol stories.
Sorry, on a story associated with the topic, which in this case is alcohol.
Yes.
Which, of note, we have been drinking Evan Williams honey whiskey today because I got it in my white elephant present for my family for Christmas, because the person that brought it might have thought of me when they bought the gift, because...
Cheers. And Jordan put it into very excellent hot toddies.
Honey whiskey makes it a lot easier.
Yes. So my story is a different kind of beer epidemic story. Okay. I told a beer epidemic story for, I think it was our toxicology episode. And this one also happens to be holiday related, which made a lot more sense when we were recording this like 2 weeks ago for the second time.
Yeah. second
time. So this story takes place on Christmas Eve in 1926.
Settle in.
Yep, settle into the roaring 20s, all the glitz and glam.
We're back in the 20s, though, so...
Oh, that's true, we are! Ooh, hopefully we don't have that same, like, crash right after knocking
on wood. Knock on wood, knock on wood.
So, Christmas Eve, 1926. A man stumbles into the emergency room at New York City's Bellevue Hospital, convinced that Santa Claus is chasing after him, wielding a baseball bat.
I mean, in my last episode, I did talk about murderous Santa Clauses, so I can see that.
That's true. That is very true. You did. But not the same thing at all. So, before the hospital staff could do anything for this guy, he died.
Womp, womp, womp.
And over the course of the night, 60 horribly ill patients come into the ED and another 8 people are dead.
Wait, 60? Like 6-0?
6-0.
Wow. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. I know my voice is very croaky, but 6-0. And then over the course of the next 2 days, yet another 23 people die in the city.
Whoops.
Yep.
Which city is this again? Sorry.
New York City.
New York City. Okay.
So what did all of these people have in common besides being in New York City? They were celebrating the holidays with some bootleg booze.
I guess it's the only option.
Thank you, Prohibition. Yeah. So for those who don't know, Prohibition, aka the 18th Amendment, was passed in 1919, and it rendered the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcohol illegal. And it was eventually reversed by the 21st Amendment, hence the name of the brewery. Mm-hmm. But we are in 1926 at the height of Prohibition. Mm-hmm. So at this time, doctors were actually kind of accustomed to dealing with alcohol poisoning.
Huh.
Because, you know, at this point, people are like very comfortable with getting their bootleg booze.
Yeah. But limiting sales helps to a certain extent, but completely outlawing, we have proven, is not the most effective method.
Correct, Mundo. So this outbreak was actually a little bit different, though. Frustrated that people had continued to consume alcohol even after it was banned, federal officials had decided to try a different kind of enforcement.
Okay.
And they ordered the poisoning of industrial alcohols manufactured in the United States.
That's not cool.
So industrial alcohols were products that were regularly stolen by bootleggers and resold as drinkable spirits.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So instead of scaring people into giving up drinking, by the time Prohibition ended in 1933, this federal poisoning program had killed at least 10,000 people in the United States. 10,000? Yes. And it was known as the Chemist's War of Prohibition.
That's a really awesome title. Yes, well done.
For something that very few people have ever heard of, yes, I'm sure. Yes. So when Prohibition passed, people continued to drink.
Of course they did.
Yeah. And alcoholism rates actually soared during the 1920s. Insurance companies charted the increase at more than 300%.
Oh, good.
Yes. So as
because now it's cool?
Now it's cool. Speakeasies?
Yeah, that's true.
Super cool. They promptly opened for business. And by the decade's end, there were some 30,000 in New York City alone.
Whew.
Yes, so plenty of places to get your bootleg booze. And rigorous enforcement had managed to slow the smuggling of alcohol from Canada and other countries, but crime syndicates responded by stealing massive quantities of industrial alcohol.
Gotcha.
And this is the stuff that's used in paints and solvents, fuels, medical supplies, that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
And you can redistill it to make it drinkable. So industrial alcohol is essentially grain alcohol, so yep, you know, like liquor, beer, whatever. But it has a bunch of unpleasant stuff mixed in to render it terrible. So the United States government started requiring this denaturing process in 1906 so that manufacturers could avoid taxes that were levied on drinkable spirits.
Okay.
And by the mid-1920s, it was estimated that some 60 million gallons of industrial alcohol were being stolen yearly to supply the country's illegal drinkers.
Impressive.
Yes. And to sell the stolen alcohol, the crime syndicates had to pay chemists to denature the alcohol and make it drinkable. So by mid-1927, the new denaturing formulas included tons of new toxins. And the one that proved to be the most deadly was methyl alcohol.
Okay. Yes. Methanol.
Methanol. And the government required this to be increased to up to 10% of the total product of industrial alcohols. And you said you mentioned methanol could get you drunk, but it's also a lot more toxic than ethanol.
I think one of my favorite episodes of House was this episode where this girl, and I can't remember all the details, so I'm sure somebody's going to write it and tell me how I got this wrong. But it was some girl who essentially tried to kill herself by drinking methanol. And so Dr. House tricked her by saying, all right, well, we're going to do shots of tequila side by side.
Yeah.
And so he slowly was like doing shots with her. But what the girl didn't realize is that the way that it works is ethanol competes for the same receptors that methanol does, and tequila, or most liquors, have ethanol. And those receptors like ethanol better. So what it'll actually do is knock out methanol and bring down the level of this more toxic thing.
Yeah.
And it'll get you drunk, but it'll also heal you, kind of. So he healed this girl by getting her drunk without her realizing what he was doing. That's and amazing. Saved her life.
I need to I'm sure I've saw that episode because I used to be obsessed with that show, but I do not remember it at all.
It's so good.
I feel like I need to rewatch it.
Do it. While doing shots of tequila.
Yes, exactly. Match House shot for shot.
Oh, yes. That seems like a safe option. Do it at home. Don't drive.
Yeah. So public health officials at this time responded with shock, you know, as you might imagine. And this article that I used as my main reference actually referred to the New York City Medical Examiner at the time, Charles Norris, as like the main public health official speaking out against this, which made my heart very happy. So he hastily organized a press conference to warn people about the outbreak that was happening in regards to this methanol poisoned industrial alcohol. And so his department continued to issue warnings to citizens detailing the dangers of the bootleg liquor. And he publicized every death by alcohol poisoning. And he assigned his toxicologist, Alexander Gettler, to analyze confiscated whiskey for poisons, just to make sure that they were staying ahead of whatever the current toxic material in them was. He also condemned the federal program for its disproportionate effect on the country's poorest residents. Mm. Because, you know, yep. wealthy people can afford
the good best stuff.
Bootleg whiskey. So he was a really cool medical examiner. Nice. One of my new heroes. So in 19...
Add it to the list.
Yes. So in 1926 in New York City, 1,200 people in total were sickened by this poisonous alcohol and 400 died.
Too many.
And the following year, you said too many, the deaths climbed to 700.
Whew.
Yes.
Ugh. Not cool.
So, fun fact, officially this special poisoning program ended only once the 18th Amendment was repealed.
That's crazy.
In December 1933. But, you know, it kind of had not been enforced long before that, but officially yeah. didn't end until 1933.
It's amazing how long it takes some of this stuff to work its way back up.
Yeah.
It's like, these are killing people. Let's just take our time. It's fine. It's fine.
Yes.
And speaking of killing people, my story is from something called the alcohol murders. So Gilbert Paul Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan.
Yeah. Was born in December 1931 in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada.
Well, his birthday also would have been in keeping with our episode
it
release.
It would have. But alas. So by 16 in 1947, Gilbert was an alcoholic and had dropped out of high school.
16?
By 16, he was already an alcoholic.
Okay.
At some point in there, he worked as a barber. So he was known as the boozing barber because he was such a heavy drinker. So to start off his series of horrible things, in 1963, so he was 32, he lured two women into his car with an invitation to drink. And then police charged him with rape and theft. So these two women he lured in, got him to drink, had sex with them in one way or another, stole stuff from him. But he ended up getting acquitted of the rape charge, essentially saying, oh, it was consensual.
Yeah.
But he still got charged with theft, so.
Well, blessings for small things.
Yeah. 2 years later, in 1965, there was a switchboard operator who joined Paul on a drinking binge and was found dead the next day with a blood alcohol content of 0.51.
Oof.
The legal limit? 0.08. So this is 0.51. This was ruled an accidental death.
Uh-huh.
So Gilbert was known to have this ravenous appetite for booze and drunken sex. And he reportedly drank over 50 ounces of vodka a day. So that's about a handle of vodka a day.
Ugh.
Besides just it's gotta be expensive.
Right.
And on top of drinking 50 ounces of vodka a day, he, according to his statements, he had sex with over 200 women per year. So just drank, and had a lot of sex. So they believe that he would find women in bars, buy them drinks, or pay them for sex, and then encourage them to drink with him. Then, once they passed out, he would pour liquor down their throats.
What?
So we talked about how alcohol poisoning in this acute large amounts of alcohol can cause respiratory depression and seizures and hypothermia and all these other things. So if you don't even know you're getting that alcohol,
yeah.
you're definitely going to get alcohol poisoning. So essentially he would murder these women by pouring alcohol down their throats. So this guy, Gilbert Paul Jordan, was heard outside of hotel rooms saying, "Have a drink, down the hatch, baby. $20 if you drink it right down. See if you're a real woman. Finish that drink. Down the hatch. Hurry. Right down. You need another drink? I'll give you $50 if you can take it. I'll give you $10, $20, $50. Whatever you want. Come on. I want to see you get it all down. You get it right down. I'll give you $50 and the $13. I'll give you $50. I told you that. If you finish that, I'll give you $75. Finish your drink. I'll give you $20. Just like over and over and over. Just
like a carnival barker.
Like carnival. Yeah, exactly. Auctioneer. Over the next 2+ decades, so this is from in the 1960s, 70s, he was associated with the deaths of 8 to 10 women. Never charged, but associated with them. He had been drinking with them before they were found dead. Yeah. So Mary Johnson was found in November of 1980 with an alcohol content of 0.34. Barbara Paul in September of 81 with 0.41. Mary Johns in July of 82 with 0.76. Patricia Thomas, December of 84, with 0.51. Patricia Andrew, June of 85, 0.79. And then finally, this one was in all of the sources, but Vera Harry, in November of 1986, with 0.04.
That's a baby amount.
This one interests me because I wonder if it's one of those she didn't have much of a tolerance and it was enough, or she was in an unsafe situation and somehow just kind of drives a point home and doesn't take a lot necessarily.
Right. Or maybe she had some sort of medical condition too.
Or something else was on board.
Yeah.
This is only talking about alcohol. And then finally, on October 12th of 1987, this woman, Vanessa Lee Buckner, was found naked on the floor of the Niagara Hotel after a night of drinking with Gilbert, with a BAC of 0.91.
What?
Jordan was questioned and was initially let go.
Where are you now?
But then they followed him and they rescued four more women from him. Two of them, I don't know their BACs, but two of them were 0.52 and 0.43.
Wow.
So finally, after this, after they had followed him for a while and had all this other evidence, he was finally charged, and the court trial accused him of poisoning her, sexually assaulting her, and leaving her to die. Vanessa Lee Buckner. Mm. And he was, in fact, convicted of manslaughter for this crime. He was initially given 15 years, but as it always is, it was reduced to 9 years.
Uh-huh.
So he, after this point, was in and out of prison for many things over time. And I couldn't find out how he died, but he finally died on July 7th, 2006, at 75-ish.
2006?
2006, so like not that long ago.
Oh, wow. Just a couple days after my 16th birthday.
Yep. So he's the first Canadian known to use alcohol as a murder weapon. And it's interesting because you associate alcohol with you drink it yourself or people are encouraging you to drink and you die from it. But he would actively pour it down their throats to get them more intoxicated so he can do whatever he wanted. And then he would just leave them. Just leave them. So please don't go drinking with random people, especially not creepy Canadians.
Named Gilbert.
But yeah, the booze and barber of British Columbia.
That is a good alliteration.
It is a very good alliteration.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that it took them so long. Like, that first incident was in 1963, and then it was 24 years later, maybe a dozen women later, that right. they finally caught him and were able to accuse him. He was only ever charged with that one crime.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
No, just also when you say they were following him, I just imagine this like crowd of cops a couple steps behind him. It's like, what you doing now, Gilbert? Hey, buddy.
I was picturing them outside in the car with like the binoculars staring in creepily on this couple having a drink at a bar.
Yeah. That's probably more what they were doing.
But yeah, no, it was just interesting because we think of alcohol as this thing that people do to themselves, but it's not necessarily just that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great resources out there if you need help. And as always, talk to your friends, family. Don't drink alone. Be safe. Text people when you're leaving places, when you get home, et cetera, et cetera. Don't drink and drive.
Yeah, don't do that. Or bike.
Or bike. Don't drink and bike.
Or e-scooter.
Don't drink and operate something other than maybe you walking, and even then make sure you're with somebody who's not drunk.
Exactly.
That's it. And yeah, so with that, Social meets.
So if you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcast platforms and other people hear about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On Insta, we're at The Dead Tell Tales.
And we have a Facebook page, Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, whatever, send us an email through the website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
And our opening theme was Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.